Chris.
Mr. Garfinkel, how are you?
I'm fine. We're just going to jump right into this.
Okay.
This is David Garfinkel. I'm here with Chris Haddad, and welcome to our special webcast, Profit During the Recession. I'm going to let Chris introduce himself in a minute, but let me tell you who I am. Most of you know me from being on my list. I'm the publisher of the World Copywriting Newsletter and the publisher of the World Copywriting Blog. I started out as a business journalist. That will become more important later as we're talking about a business journalist's article, which is going to send a lot of people plunging into panic and depression. I'm no longer that. I'm a marketer and an entrepreneur, copywriter, teacher of copywriting, and I'm an expert on direct marketing for small businesses. I've worked with hundreds and helped thousands through various products and seminars and so forth. I've written 6 books or co-authored and written myself 6 books, including Advertising Headlines That Make You Rich, and co-author with Jay Levinson on Guerrilla Copywriting, both available on Amazon if you're interested. But we promised we're not going to sell anything, so please don't buy those books today. Just listen to what we have to say. I've worked with hundreds of businesses. I've seen a lot of businesses fail, especially during the 2 major recessions when I've been in business as a marketing consultant and marketer, because they were following the wrong map. And the reason I'm putting this together with Chris as a free webcast is to help people avoid this fate. Chris is a mentoring client of mine. He's such a good copywriter that I have him do some of my own projects, and I refer him rather frequently to high-level people who are 100% satisfied with him so far. But he's such a modest guy. I'm not going to try and build up his ego. Chris, why don't you just tell people a little bit about you, and then we'll talk about what we're going to do, and we're going to help people avoid the recession. Okay?
Okay. This might be the first time ever that anyone's ever actually called me modest, so thank you, David. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Yeah, my name is Chris Haddad, often referred to as Chris Mr. Moneyfingers Haddad these days, which I think is a pretty fun little title to have. My own background is...
Tell him why. Moneyfingers.
Why? Mr. Moneyfingers, because I got that from a client of mine named Joe Barton a while back, because I was writing letters for him and his business, and he was making so much gosh darned money off these sales letters we were putting up that he just started referring to me that over email, and it kind of stuck.
See what I mean by modest, folks? Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. My own background is, you know, after college for a while there, I was working down in Los Angeles, California, doing film and television work, and then moved to Seattle, Washington, and a few years back discovered the wild and wacky world of marketing. So these days I work as a direct response copywriter, marketing consultant, and all-around marketing wonk for all sorts of fun people. I've done a lot of work for Microsoft, for Washington Mutual, and in the, you know, the seedy underbelly of direct marketing, I've done a lot of work for folks like Jim Fleck, Jeff Paul, Sean Casey, Michael Cage, and, of course, my favorite copywriting mentor, David Garfinkel. And before we kind of dive in, one thing I want to touch on is, you know, we're talking about the recession today and, you know, how people react to the recession and what people do with their business. And I got to say that for me, when I see a recession coming, it just makes me excited because I know that my business is going to go up. I know that as, you know, with the economy turning down these days, my phone is ringing off the hook from clients because they understand that a dollar they spend on smart marketing is even more important when the economy is in the state it's in right now. But I'm really excited to be talking to David today, not just a great mentor for copywriters, but really the world's greatest teacher of copywriting, and I think we're all going to learn a ton of stuff today.
Chris, you're making the modest me blush just by saying that. Thank you very much for the high praise. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about why businesses have trouble in a recession, and I'm going to try and change your mind, you, the listener, person listening to this webcast, about what a recession is, because I think it's different than even the smartest PhD economists think it is. And I'm looking at it from the point of view of, like Chris, more people want my services at this time of in this cycle of the economy, but I think I have some insights that will help you make more money more quickly and perhaps rise above your competitors who are going to be behaving more like sheep, I would say. So we'll talk about what the conventional wisdom is, why it doesn't work. I think I have somewhere on my cluttered desk an article that I snagged off of the web from Smart Money magazine about the recession, which, you know, was written with all good intentions and which I think sort of shows the flawed approach that of the advice most people are getting and giving, and we'll tell you what to do instead. We're going to give you some very specific stuff. We're going to give you the same kind of stuff people are calling us for with no strings attached, no request for business. We're both very busy, but we would like to help you. And we'll tell you how to put these methods to work for you. So you should have a mini recession-proofing plan ready to go by the end of this hour. The way it's going to work, yeah, that's good, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like Chris will interview me.
That's great.
Chris is, he's like I said, he's tremendously successful. One thing I mentioned on my blog, he wrote a sales letter for Jeff Paul, and Jeff, I guess, like many entrepreneurs, was a little impatient, so he used the sales letter as the outline for a teleseminar he did with people on his customer base and his subscription list and made $96,000. Actually, by the time it was all over, the one-hour call had turned into $300,000. Now, that may not be the kind of business you're in or want to be in, but that's what Chris knows. So, Chris, why don't you start? And I don't want you to just interview me. I want you to contribute to the conversation because you're really in the game, too, and you have a lot of success to talk about. So please start.
Well, thank you, David. I appreciate it. Let's just dive right in. So, David, in your not-so-humble opinion, what happens during a recession that makes businesses get in trouble? What is it they do when they see the economy going down? It just kind of hamstrings them, basically.
Well, I'm going to use a very simple comparison. I'm going to talk about the engine of a car. You know, when you're getting on the freeway and you're getting up to 55 or 60 or 70 or, like we drive in the freeways here, 80, 85 miles an hour, there's a time when the engine is slow, and then it starts to go faster, and it's going fast for a while. Then when you get off the freeway and you go into residential area, it slows down. The engine slows down. And the economy is sort of like a car. It's also not like a car, but we're going to talk about the way it is like a car in that things start to slow down. Businesses notice that the number of sales are going down. They notice that the size of the sales are going down. If they're getting a $100 average sale, maybe now they're getting 90 or 80 or even 70. Their profits go down because their expenses stay the same. So if it costs the business $1,000 a month to run and they were making $3,000 a month before, 3 minus 1, this isn't going to be a math lesson, but they were making $2,000 profit. Now all of a sudden they're making $1,500 a month, and it still costs them $1,000 a month. Their profit has gone down by three quarters. Instead of making $2,000 a month, they're barely squeaking by with $500 profit. So what do they think? They think, oh, I know, I'll cut costs. If I cut costs, then I'll have the profit I was having before. Well, that's not exactly the best way to do it.
And it's really the definition of what a cost is where they get trouble, right? It's like, you know, cutting.
Well, that's an important point because often people think that the marketing they're doing is a cost, and if they can just, you know, reduce the marketing, then everything will be fine. The marketing is what brings in the customers.
Mm-hmm.
Other costs are like people who answer the phone or, hey, how about the cost of paying the electric company or the phone company to keep the phone on? That's a cost you really don't want to sort of stretch out too much. So, sometimes people are running sloppy, they're running fat, they're spending too much money. So you can tighten things up a little bit, but that's not a good recession strategy. That's just sort of letting the engine slow down as much as you can. And that's not what you want to do.
And what happens when people start doing that? When people start going through and they take that really harsh kind of attitude, and they start cutting all of their expenditures, cutting their investments, cutting the amount they're paying to their employees, cutting what they're spending on good marketing, and such like that. You know, what happens in that situation?
Well, what happens is they speed up the slowing down effect. I know that sounds contradictory. Instead of going from 60 to 30 to 20, they go from 60 to 20 to 10 to 5. To maybe a dead stop, to where the engine is idling. They economize themselves out of business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've probably seen this too.
You have to spend money to make money, right? And if they're basically cutting all of their expenditures so close to the bone that the stuff they were spending on that was actually bringing in customers and making them money, they're not spending that money anymore.
Well, here's the problem, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of businesses are spending money, and they think that the money they're spending is bringing them in customers, and it's actually not. They were actually spending money on marketing that wasn't working very well, but the economy was so good that it was almost the law of averages that was bringing the customers in. I mean, you actually worked as one of those marketers until you saw the light about direct response, did you
not?
Back
in the day. I actually just got in a debate with somebody today online talking about, what is good marketing? And this person who I won't name was talking about, you have to be really clever and you have to be really funny and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, or you could just do something that works. You could just write a sales letter or write an ad that actually gets people interested in what you have to sell and actually do it. Yeah.
Right. I think the big myth is that you need to, quote, get your name in front of the public and that's going to get you sales. Well, people generally like to be familiar with companies that they buy from, but the problem is they don't buy just because they're familiar.
Mm-hmm.
They need more than that. They need a reason to buy, and they need trust. They need to feel a certain amount of comfort with the company that they're going to buy from. And, that is the problem, that most people don't understand what they need to do in marketing in the first place. The funny thing is, it doesn't matter that much if you don't understand what kind of marketing works. During boom times, during good times, you can usually, throw enough spaghetti against the wall to see what sticks. During recession times, when everything's slowing down, you need to be more of a sharpshooter and hit your targets with more accuracy on a regular basis. Now, here's something you and I were talking about, Chris, which I've never heard anyone else talk about before. You know, most people think about a recession being the kind of situation where people, they're acting sort of poor and they're holding onto their money more tightly and they're not spending it. And I would agree with most of that. Customers are more careful, but the reality is, and this is ironic, and I've never heard this before, I believe that customers are acting, ordinary people are acting more like wealthy people in one way.
Mm-hmm.
In that wealthy people, people with money, are generally more careful. Despite you read about Charlie Sheen giving a waitress $1,000 tip, and you say, oh, that's what rich people are like. No.
Mm-hmm.
No. Most wealthy people, they will spend money, but they really want value, and they're very particular, and they're very careful about it. That's the way more and more of the general public, people all the way up and down the economic ladder, tend to behave. So you need to adjust what you're doing in your business to make the more careful buyer more likely to buy from you.
That's a fantastic point. I mean, anyone that's worked in marketing, especially trying to sell either high-ticket items or selling to rich people, it's like basically getting pliers and ripping it out of their pocket. Anybody that's really, especially someone who's self-made rich, who's worked their way up there, the way they got that way was by being careful. Whereas people that tend to be lower on the economic ladder, they really do tend to be a little bit freer with their cash. They don't think about saving it as much. They don't worry about it as much. They're waiting for the next paycheck. But in an economy like this, all of a sudden, it's a much tougher, everything is a tougher sale. You have to work for every sale.
Yeah, and so this is something that anyone who is wealthy or who hires, has wealthy clients that they market for, because I know we have a lot of marketers listening to this webcast, or just anyone who isn't used to selling to the rich in the first place should find interesting. Now, let me tell you about a couple of things. Well, first of all, I got an email. It was like a mass email from my friend Perry Marshall this morning, and he was going off on how there is no recession, and and I think he was trying to be sort of funny, and he said CNN and CBS have correctly predicted 20 of the last two recessions, and there's too many things going on. I mean, I have clients who are actually, this client has told you because there's someone I referred to you who had a $2 million business, and he was like the canary in the mine shaft, the one who found out early last fall. Tell people in Michigan that there's no recession. Tell someone who's surrounded by foreclosed homes, including possibly their own in Florida, there's no recession. Look at all the indicators of production, consumer confidence. They're all pointing sort of down right now. Look at people waiting for the next shoe to drop on Wall Street because of the subprime crisis. We really are heading for an economic contraction. The engine is going to be slowing down. That's real. You can, say, no, it's just the media trying to get more eyeballs on TV, but I think if you're listening to this webcast, you probably have a suspicion that it might be true. Now, there's this article I have in front of me, Chris. It's by Diana Ransom. She's a writer, I guess, for Smart Money, which is published by Dow Jones, which publishes the Wall Street Journal. And I pulled this off of AOL Small Business. I couldn't find it on the Smart Money site. But it's called Quick Tips, How to Recession-Proof Your Business. And actually, I've been thinking about doing this teleseminar for a while, but when I saw this, I knew I had to, because this is so typical of what people see. So she spends 9 paragraphs talking about somebody who's concerned about a recession, and then she's talking to the director of macroeconomics at Moody's, economy.com. Well, that, I don't know. I've met these economists, and I don't know. They don't really seem to have much to offer for the business owner, and they're talking about the tax package, which is going to put a maximum of $1,200 or $1,600, the stimulus package in people's hands. That's not going to affect any one business that much, perhaps, except for maybe casinos. And then talking about energy prices, all of these macroeconomic things, which I'm going to be like Keith Olbermann and just rip that page up, throw it away. Then there are 9 suggestions, and there are things like cut costs, ratchet down inventory, reserve discounts, invest in employees, free up cash flow, renegotiate contracts, look to expand your business. The ones that have anything to do with customers are very vague and specific, and there's nothing in here about getting new business. It's almost like people assume, well, it's a recession, so forget about getting new customers.
So no new customers are going to come through the door. People aren't going to want to buy bread anymore because it's a recession. Right?
Oh, no. They go on a bread-free diet.
Mm-hmm. They're going to go on a food-free diet. They're all going to become breatharians.
It's like anytime you drive a car, you don't drive a car, but that's by choice, I guess. But you could certainly afford a couple cars right now if you wanted. But, you put on the brakes sometimes and you accelerate. And, economy goes up and goes down. The key thing is to go with the flow, to figure out which way the energy is going and which way the wind is blowing, and trim your sails for the maximum benefit to yourself. So, that is the problem I have with the advice. The 2 pieces of advice that are sort of good about bringing more cash into business are very, very vague. Mm-hmm. Focus on service, but doesn't really say what that means. And don't start discounting.
It seems like what you're saying is the tips that you got out of this article, they're mostly aimed at, they wouldn't be aimed at what we would consider small business at all, right? They'd be aimed at, like, big companies, companies with many, many employees, et cetera. And even then, it's not good advice.
Well, right? That's right. I mean, it wasn't even clear who it was aimed at. It was basically a professional reporter talking to a bunch of people that look like experts, and the experts being very convincing, saying nothing. Even giving us consultants like us a bad name. There was nothing in there that said, here's a way to increase your cash flow and keep your profits at the same level or higher during a recession. But there are ways to do that. You know that, and I know that.
There's actually even ways to make, depending on what business you're in, you can make more money than you were making before in a recession. It just depends how you position your products, how you position your services, and how you kind of tap into what the needs of the market are in this particular economy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just have a very different point of view about this.
Yeah. So tell us what your experience and your philosophy is about making money during a recession. What's your big belief on it?
Well, first of all, most of the businesses that I work with are already doing the things that are being suggested in the article in terms of keeping costs down, keeping terms tight, keeping the fat trimmed, really trying to make the the operations part of the business as efficient as possible. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not an expert in that. I'm not particularly good at that. But I think it's a good prerequisite. My specialty is using free or inexpensive or even in some cases self-liquidating, meaning it pays for itself, marketing techniques to help businesses grow, sometimes grow substantially. One business in Phoenix, Arizona, which is, if Sally Baker is on this call, as I think she is, from Great Ideas PR, Sally referred this business to me. Thank you, Sally. This is in early 90s, and it was called Abacus Travel Management. I wrote a sales letter for them. They mailed it out. They had a very targeted mailing list. It was a three-page letter, and the long and the short of it is they mailed out 25 at a time, and they had to stop mailing it. The response was too great. They got $5 million worth of business that repeated over and over again. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. It's just not going to work for everybody in the same numbers in the same way. But again,
it's a really simple thing to do, right? I mean, how expensive it is it? They have to pay you, obviously. But beyond that, how expensive is it to just mail out? It's a great letter, too. I read that letter and studied the hell out of it. But, you know, how expensive is it to direct response mail that actually works?
And the point here is not direct response mail. It's that there are three techniques we're going to talk about, and this letter used all three of them.
Great.
And you don't need to be able to write a good direct mail letter to use these techniques. There are lots of ways to do it. We'll talk about that. I want to tell you another success story. I had a client. He had an unpublished book with great information in it, and his name is Stuart Lichtman. The book is How to Get Lots of Money for Anything Fast. So far, he sold $1.2 million worth of this book as an e-book selling electrons, so his product cost is relatively minimal. But I don't only work with multi-million dollar situations. I had an auto body shop in San Ramon, California, put together a flyer for him. He mailed the flyer to his Chamber of Commerce, and he left me a voicemail saying that he's never seen any kind of response like this. 99% of the people were 100% sold on getting their cars detailed when I called him up. Oh, look, I'm not telling all these things to brag. I have experience in over 100 industries, life coaching, credit card processing, hydroponic fertilizers, alumni associations. I'm telling you these things to show that the techniques, which you and I are going to talk about, Chris, they're simple and they don't need to cost much to implement, and they'll work for all kinds of businesses.
So simple stuff that can work for whether you're like a one-man shop who's doing massage therapy or somebody who's doing information marketing and making, you know, several hundred thousand dollars a year, this is stuff that can apply no matter where you are in the business spectrum.
Yeah, right now I have a client that has a $25 million a year entrepreneurial business, customers in 23 countries. I have other clients that are one-person businesses, and it's always been like that. These are entrepreneurial techniques, so if, you know, you need to have a very high-gloss image, and we're talking about lots of expensive collateral material and you know, very expensive offices, and that's not what this is about. These are for businesses that are interested in providing unique value to customers, and they're willing to do slightly against the grain marketing techniques that are less about image and more about creating relationships with customers.
Now, fantastic. And I know you're going to touch on that value concept there quite a bit more later. Great.
Now,
so if you shouldn't focus on cutting costs and stretching out payments to vendors when the recession hits or when we're in the middle of the recession like we are now, what should you focus on?
Well, you know, there are lots of people that are going to say you should be focusing on the things that in the Diana Ransom article. But when you think about it, 8 out of 10 businesses fail within the first 5 years in the United States, which may be the best place to start an entrepreneurial business. And I don't know why, but I think what you need to focus on is things you can do that keep you profitable and make your customers really happy. So instead of focusing on cutting costs and playing with numbers and stretching out payments to, you know, sure, you want to keep your cash is always king. You want to keep your cash flow good. You want to tighten your ship. You want to put most of your time and your energy and your focus into developing more business from the customers you have now, which is possible, mm-hmm. and getting new customers. And instead of thinking that people are tightening their belts, put on the thinking cap that says people are being more careful with their purchases. That's different. They might spend the money, but they might yeah. need a little more information. They might need a little more feeling of comfort, feeling of security than mm-hmm. they had before.
So really, I mean, it's like they're still going to spend money on something, right? People are still going to want entertainment. They're still going to want good value. They're still going to want to learn, you know, great ideas and such, but they're going to be more selective about where they spend that money.
Yeah, and let's be honest. There are some people that are going to be, you know, you hear the presidential candidates talking about these people who are working two jobs and they still can't pay their heating bill or their health care. And I believe that. There are people like yeah. that in this economy right now. So, okay, we're not talking about those people as customers. My heart goes out to them, and they don't have the money to spend, so we're not going to try and, you know, get them to take a paycheck loan or you know, mortgage their house or whatever it is. But there are a lot of people who are just the way you describe them, Chris.
Yeah.
And those people will spend money. They need to buy things. They want things. They're just going to do it in a slightly more careful way. And here's the good news about the techniques we're going to talk about. They don't require that you cut your prices. A lot of people think, oh, I'm going to have to. Everybody has to become a Walmart and a Target during a recession. No. No, you don't have to. In fact, the better example to be is become more like a Nordstrom or more like a Neiman Marcus. Not in your prices. Not that your prices have to go through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of value and customer care and giving people the experience that it's really worth spending money with your business.
Mm-hmm. So those probably, I think there's a huge opportunity in recession like this because, you know, brand loyalty, people always talk about branding. The old world I used to live in was all about building up your brand.
Mm-hmm.
But in a recession, brands don't matter as much as value. People are looking to get more for their dollar. Right. So if you're competing with people who have, you know, done really kind of shiny sort of brand advertising but don't give value, and you do, it's a real opportunity to start taking customers away from them.
Right? That's absolutely right, because for as many people as are listening to this, and we may have over 1,000 people on this call, there are millions and millions of business owners who will never get this information,
mm-hmm.
and you're in a great advantage place. You're in a advantageous position if you know it. So what are these three things now that I think we've set the stage for them? Well, the first one is demonstration. Demonstration. And demonstration simply means showing people your product or service, showing them how it works and how it will benefit them, and get into the nitty-gritty details that are going to answer questions they might have on their mind, like, will this work for me? Is this too hard to do it? Is it too complicated to do it? So that's one, demonstration. Number
and
two,
And with number two?
Yeah, that's sampling. Let people experience your product or service. Let them have a sample. We'll talk about that a lot. And I know that you've been using these techniques yourself. That's one reason mm-hmm. that all of your marketing consulting is so successful. The third thing is relationship. So many, you know, I had to call a cab yesterday, and, I mean, this guy couldn't wait to get me off the phone. And the cab went to the wrong house, and I kept getting these automated calls from the cab company saying that my cab was there, my cab was there, my cab was there. And the cab wasn't there. And when I called the guy, as soon as he got my street address, he tried to hang up the phone. I mean, talk about a lack of relationship. You
it's
know?
Like an abusive relationship at that point, right? They're just kind of like, you know, they know you're going to give them your money anyway at that point, so they don't care. They're not thinking long term.
No, he wasn't. So the way to approach relationship is to go beyond being generic and being a commodity to being human and having some bonding with your customers, which, you know, I finally forced him to do. I said, whoa, wait a minute. I said, you know, you keep calling me and telling me I'm there. He said, well, you weren't outside. And, well, then the cabbie shows up, and he's red-faced, and he was on the wrong block and so forth. So I went, whew, you know, I didn't think I'd screwed that up. I was watching pretty carefully. But you never know.
Let's talk about the first thing you talked about, demonstrating your product or service for people. And I think actually something we need to touch on is, I'm sure a lot of people that are on the call today, they're in service businesses, they're in info product businesses, they're not selling Ginsu knives, right? They're selling, you know, things that aren't physical that might be, that at least on the face of them, seem harder to demonstrate. But let's talk about what demonstration is and how you use it in business.
Okay, well, actually, Ginsu knives are a good place to start, but we want to go beyond that. If you think about, if you like to watch infomercials, or if you ever got stuck watching an infomercial, if you don't like infomercials, they are classic examples. I love the 1 or 2 minute infomercials where they have something like, you know, the picture frame that's for digital pictures, and they show you exactly how it works, and then they give you the price, and then you get a second one, and then you get another doodad that goes with it, and what, you know, think of Ron Popeye, I don't know how to say his name, but you know who I mean? The cooking guy. That's a real good model to start with in terms of demonstration. The thing about that is you can watch this on TV, and after you've watched a few minutes, you know what the product is and how it works and how you use it. And a lot of people end up imagining using it themselves. Now, can you do this what does an infomercial cost? My goodness, $500,000, $1 million to really produce it?
If you can even get on the air at this point. But,
yeah. Maybe you can get on the air. However, what does it cost to do a web video?
Like nothing at this point.
Like nothing You know, very little. You can get yourself a little web camera. You can get yourself a professional quality camera for a few hundred dollars, actually, these days.
But doing, you know, web video that people will respond to that looks at least professional enough is extraordinarily cheap these days.
Yeah, and you know what? If video scares you, you can get yourself a digital camera, and you can have a series of photos on the web. You can have a series of photos, and you can run audio underneath it, or you can have captions. You can start to show people how your product, how your service works. You can, you know, show. I mean, there's a on the cable channel that I watch sometimes. There's a local dentist, and he just basically takes you into his office. And this is San Francisco. He's Chinese, and then there's another Chinese woman next to him. And she says, "Y hablamos español." We speak Spanish too, so Spanish-speaking people know that they can go to this Chinese dentist. Well, this is San Francisco. Everything's a big melting pot here. But, you know, you really feel like you've been to Dr. Jang's office by the time you've watched that commercial, because he has used the principle of demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you what, if a dentist can do it on cable TV, you can do it for your business. I don't care what it is, because I've worked for 3 different dental marketing consultants. I've helped people who market their services to dentists to teach them how to market their services, okay? And dentists are pretty resistant to doing this, believe it or not. They're very technical, sort of introverted people. They're very good at their jobs, but maybe not that open to marketing. So if a dentist can do this, you can do this. Trade show, swap meet, Chamber of Commerce trade show, you know? Think of a way to show people what you do. Get up and give a speech at the Rotary or at some community organization.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you're in a personality-based business, like you're a consultant or something like that. It's a tremendous way to get out there and get people to understand how you work and who you are.
That's right, because a lot of the reasons people won't even approach you, see, the problem with the whole branding approach to marketing is that it's true, it's just a half-truth. It's not fully true. The assumption of marketing is once people are familiar with your business, then they automatically become your customers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not true. You know that's not true. I know that's not true.
Not at all.
Unless, you know, you're in an oasis and, you know, you're in the desert and you're the only water supplier in town, then all they need to know is that you're there. But in any kind of competitive marketplace, they need more than familiarity. But if they know who you are and they feel comfortable with who you are, that's half the battle. Familiarity not only breeds contempt, it breeds customers. But then you need to do, they need to know more than who you are and feel comfortable. They need to know what you do and what's in it for them and what it would be like to do business with you. And you can start that process with demonstration.
Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine, I know plenty of cases where I've gone, have been interested in buying something based on the benefits that someone was projecting toward me, but couldn't figure out what I was actually going to get. They didn't demonstrate what the product was, how it would actually work, how I would actually use it, and lost the sale because of that.
Right. And, you know, if there are any retailers on the call, this is a great opportunity for you, because you go to a big box store like, you know, a Best Buy or something, and very often the salespeople will be annoyed if you have any questions about how something works. And if they're nice and they're not annoyed, they may not know how to actually show you. There are too many products and they haven't been trained. So if you can simply show people how to do this, whether it's in your store or on the web, you know, that's a big plus. And I've helped a lot of businesses grow that way. There are a lot of ways to demonstrate that it goes perhaps beyond the scope of what we're covering here, but you can do demonstration through case studies and through testimonials where you talk about how another customer used it and what they discovered in the process of using your business or the service that your business offers or the product that your business offers or the information that your business offers. And people reading that will experience a demonstration of your business that way.
Mm-hmm. Something I've done in my own business when I was looking for consulting clients is just recorded consulting calls with people. Basically gotten permission to record a call, a 30-minute consultation, just put it on the web so people can hear the kind of advice I was giving somebody, how to lead them through things like that, and it got a tremendous response from me. So
That's excellent. That's a perfect example. Now, it took a lot of chutzpah to ask someone to do that, but, you know, people are smart when they realize that by listening to you consulting to them, they might get customers just out of the exposure. But you got even and more clients, it sounds like.
It was really a win-win for both of us, I find. I've done it a few times for folks, and it usually works out quite well. So one of the big questions we want people on the call to think about right now, and what they should be, you know, madly scribbling in their notebooks, is brainstorming how they can demonstrate what they have to offer to their customers and to get their business. What can they do? No matter what kind of business they're in, what kind of demonstration can they put on, whether it be on the web, in person, whatever it's going to be.
Yes, so let me phrase the question you just asked in the form of a question.
There you go.
Why doesn't everybody write this down? How could you, or how could I, not David, I, but, you know, you, the person listening, how could I offer my prospect a demonstration of what they get from my business? How could I offer my prospect a demonstration of what they get from my business? So, yeah, if you write that question down, that will be part of your action plan at the end of this call.
Cool. So let's move on to number two, which was sampling. And I think it probably would be useful to explain the difference between demonstration and sampling. And
yeah.
To talk about how sampling
is. Sure. Well, let's put it this way. You're in your living room or wherever, if you watch TV, and I know Mr. Haddad doesn't watch TV, but
I watch a lot of movies.
Watch movies. Okay, so, and you're an actor. You have a background as an actor. So what's the difference between sampling and demonstration? Well, demonstration is when you're watching the movie. Sampling is when you get to be in the movie. At least for a little while. So I have a good friend, Patricia Fripp. Many people have heard of her. She's very famous. She's a keynote speaker, first woman president. She beat Hillary Clinton by... not exactly in the same field, but if Hillary wins the election by 24 years. In 1984, Patricia was the first female president of the National Speakers Association. And she is now a speech coach, an executive speech coach. And one of the things, she will do a couple of things after she has qualified a prospect that, you know, would be appropriate for her to work with, who can afford her, and who'd really be interested in her services and could get value out of it. She'll talk to them for 5 or 10 minutes on the phone. Well, a conversation with her, I can tell you, after having had many conversations with her, 5 or 10 minutes with her could be like an hour with an ordinary person. Her mind just moves so quickly, and she brings so much value. Or she might review someone's tape and make a few suggestions so they will get a sampling of what having her as a coach for a whole day is like. And she gets people from all across the country to spend considerable amounts of money to bring her in, major best-selling authors, top keynote speakers, and so forth. She's really, really good. And yet someone who's really, really good and really, really booked uses this sampling technique because why? It works. And it builds a lot of trust. You know, not only are you not, you know, the old joke about the lawyer who walks through the park and says hello and sends someone a bill for 3 minutes of his time. You know, it's the opposite of that dynamic. It's like, hey, I'm willing to extend myself, I being the business owner, to you to give you a sample of my work, and you can see what it's like. No foul, no harm.
Yeah. And it really just proves early on that you're not selling snake oil, right? That you're not just being, you know, marketers are distrusted, I would say, in a lot of ways. You know, people, everybody's selling something, and everybody says they don't want to be sold.
Well, businesses are distrusted. And, I mean, that's part of what happens. The distrust sentries, you know, get activated in people. The more cautious buyer is a little more distrustful of all these people who want their money, even if they want what the person's selling. So, yeah, it lowers resistance, and it's a legitimate way of establishing trust. Let's talk about a more automated service. I have Sirius satellite radio in my car, and I can listen to it on my computer now. I love that. It actually sounds better than my stereo, which sort of bothers me, but it does. If you're interested in it, you can, and you don't have a subscription, you can go to Sirius.com and get a 3-day free trial online. You can listen to all of the satellite stations that they offer online free for 3 days. That's a sample. My gosh, software. There are so many examples of that with software. Even Microsoft has this, mm-hmm. and they were one of your clients, weren't they?
They were, yeah, way back. Not that way back. I mean, I've done a bunch of work for Microsoft, and I have lots to say about the way Microsoft does their marketing. But, yeah, I mean, they were a little late to the party, actually, I would say, in sampling. If you look at Apple, they basically let you sample pretty much all of the software.
You're a Mac guy. We're not going to get into fisticuffs, are we?
No, not at all. We'll just get into a thumb wrestling match, which I will win.
Okay.
But actually, a big example of sampling, you know, people were saying, oh, you know, you can only sample small products.
I didn't say I was a Microsoft guy, by the way. I just like Windows machines. Yeah.
But, I mean, if you look at one very high-ticket item is, you know, Photoshop, Adobe Photoshop, which costs over $1,000, I think, for the software if you want to download it or if you want to buy it. But if you go to Adobe.com right now, you can download the full Adobe Photoshop and try it for, I think, it's 30 days absolutely free. You know,
yep.
No charge, no nothing. What a company like Adobe, who makes millions and millions of dollars, is the standard, the industry standard for designers and people that want to make pretty pictures, would they do something like that if it didn't work? Well, hell no.
Of course not.
And my own clients, we're doing more and more sampling these days.
Can you give me some real-time, real-life examples of what you're doing?
Well, one very simple one is I was recently doing work for Michael Cage, who's a referral that came to me from you. And Michael is the real deal. I mean, as far as going and doing teleseminars and webinars and actually learning how to do teleseminars and webinars that make people money, he's the guy. He's, you know, he's the one you want to go to.
I agree.
And we decided that, you know, a big
may I interrupt? Mm-hmm. No one's ever heard of him.
Nobody's ever heard
of him. If you haven't been to a Dan Kennedy seminar or a Matt Fury seminar, you've never heard of Michael Cage. I almost guarantee it.
He's basically the hidden giant of teleseminars and webinars. He's made millions and millions of dollars for people. He's made quite a bit of cash for himself doing these things. But nobody's ever heard of him. He's not out there in the public consciousness or even in the entrepreneurial consciousness. So what we're doing with a lot of his marketing materials is giving away content, giving away, you know, samples of stuff you can use right now to make money on your teleseminars and webinars. We're just giving it away out there so that people can see without a doubt, he's the real deal. That when somebody takes the information that we're giving for free, they'll be able to put it into action, we'll have an immediate result from it, and we'll know that his items that he's actually selling, which aren't cheap by any measure, are worth every dollar.
So he's sampling extremely high-priced, high-value, high-ROI advice. He's giving
mm-hmm.
people little ideas that they can use to make big money, and if they like it, then they can buy his high-end course. That's pretty bold.
In a lot of ways, he's giving away stuff that other people are charging for right now, basically. And also, if you look at some other people, something I'm doing with my clients that I've seen other people do is basically letting people sample your entire product for free, basically saying, you know what, you can take this, with the Recent Info product. Take it, use it, put it into action. I'm going to take your credit card information now, but if you don't like it, send it back within 30 days and I won't even charge you, which is a really, I would say, a very ballsy way of doing sampling. But
I would, too.
If you've got the cuts before it, if you've got the cash, you can afford to do that. And the key here is if you believe that your product is valuable enough for that, if you believe that your product and know that your product can stand up to that kind of thing, do it.
But I want to make a point that when you do something like that, you're putting a lot on the line and there's the whole product cost and the shipping and that's okay. But sampling doesn't have to be that involved. You can just let them sample a little bit of something. You know, I mean, think about the at grocery stores, especially on the weekends, they'll have a new vendor with a new cheese or a new dish or a new
mm-hmm.
something.
Actually, David, that was my first ever job when I was like 15.
Really?
First I was a bag boy. I was the third fastest bag boy in Massachusetts, and then I got drafted.
Did you go to a bag boy competition?
I did, actually. There was a competition. I was the fastest bag boy, but they didn't like my technique as much, and I found it afterwards.
Oh, so you got marked down for technique?
I got marked down. I was a very dour 15-year-old kid, and I had a lot of speed in my hands, but I didn't really, I wasn't careful enough with the eggs. Nothing broke.
You didn't smile?
I didn't smile. I didn't have the persona for it, but I was very, very fast. I found out afterwards that if I had gotten first place, I would have gotten a free trip to Hawaii. My dad was very mad that I didn't win, but that's okay.
Yes, but you weren't sampling the personality that the judges wanted.
Exactly, but I was giving out samples of Parmalat milk, which was basically warm milk from Europe, and sold more of that stuff than anybody's ever seen in my store just by giving it out, being polite, letting people try the product and decide, giving them...
So
giving
you
them
were actually in a better mood when you were sharing the Parmalat milk than when you were putting food in bags.
I think that's probably true. I'm sure my therapist have a lot to say about that, but yes, definitely.
Well, I didn't mean to go there, excuse me. Okay, well, that's good. So sampling, yeah, it works again. I think we've gone from Microsoft to Massachusetts grocery stores to Patricia Fripp on the phone to Sirius Satellite Radio. It works.
Mm-hmm.
And most businesses don't do it. Most businesses don't think they could do it. Most businesses simply haven't put on their thinking caps and answered this question. And
But there are definitely ways for you to do sampling even without having it be a lot of work on your part.
Here's the question people should write down.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how can you offer prospects a sample of what they get from you in your business?
I can hear the Jeopardy theme song going off in my head right now. Exactly, as people madly scribble around.
That's right. How could you offer your prospect a sample of what they get in your business? Now, let's talk about your business, Chris. You used a demo is very good. Did you ever use any kind of sample where someone said, how good are you? You say, well, just let me talk to you for 5 minutes, and if you like it, then we can book an hour?
Yeah, what I do, if you go to my own website, especially when I'm not as I'm freaking booked now, but that's okay. But I do certainly have times when I basically say, if somebody goes to my site, fills out the form, sends me their information, if it looks like a real business and they've got something that's interesting, I'll give them a free half-hour consultation for free. I'll basically get on the line and talk about, how is your copy doing, what is your sales process doing, et cetera, things like that. And it does great. It gives them a chance to, and my goal, of course, is when I'm doing that, is to give them real, actionable, useful stuff. Right.
And, I think there's a cumulative effect, too.
Yeah.
Did I say that right? Cumulative? Cumulative effect, because You're saying right now that people are banging down the doors to work mm-hmm. with you. Well, I don't think it's just because of what you do. I think that's part of it, but I think, you know, you plant a lot of seeds when you do stuff like this,
mm-hmm.
when you do the Great. Sampling and the demo.
So it all catches up to you. You hear, I mean, I've had plenty of cases where I've had a half-hour consultation with somebody, even somebody I knew that I wasn't going to be able to work with. Somebody I knew didn't have the budget or wasn't at a place where they could basically go from there. And it always turns around. You know, if you give people good samples and show them what you can do well and, you know, let them know that your product is the real deal, I get a lot of referrals that way. I get a lot of people who come back later and, you know, I get a call from somebody in Germany this morning who, you know, knew someone who I did a consulting call with 6 months ago
mm-hmm.
and wants to hire me. So it definitely does build up and work in your favor.
And I think you've just proven that it works across international borders.
Even with German people with charming accents. Let's move on to number three.
Number three is relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, relationship is one of those, you know, in customer service and in enlightened business, it has become one of those motherhood and apple pie type of things, you know. But I think we sort of talked about how a relationship wasn't working so well between me and the taxi cab company. I won't say the name of the company, but it begins with L and it ends with R, in San Francisco. But, you know, and anytime you go through a voicemail tree or you talk to a customer service representative that sounds like they're reading a script,
mm-hmm.
It tends to diminish the relationship. You ever notice that?
Oh, I have many, many a time, actually. I have a whole story about, I think on my blog somewhere, there's a whole story about my horrible, horrible experience when I tried to buy my big foam mattress and got really, really bad customer service from a company with a good product, right? Because they weren't willing to establish a good relationship and take care of people, it cost them a lot. Whereas just this week I had to get new glasses, my old glasses broke, and this company went above and beyond the call of duty to be nice to me, to have my relationship. I'll send referrals to them until the day I die at this point, just because they're willing to be there and be human beings.
Being a human being, well, you know, I know there are going to be some people on this call that say, okay, so you said be a human being, but how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a fair question if it comes up. One thing is handwritten notes. There are these awful stories about all the presidents who write handwritten notes at the end of the day, and I don't want to get into that. But a simple handwritten note, a thank you note, you know, most people don't have time to do them, and those who take the time to do it will really create a relationship when someone buys from you, sending them a thank you note. When you see somebody, it helps if it's sincere and it's not mechanical, if you actually take a moment to reflect on you know, what transpired, what happened,
mm-hmm.
and you're writing about that. So that's one way of building up relationship. And, oh, these things do matter. I don't know. I don't have any stories right off the top of my head. Maybe you do or don't about handwritten notes, but, yeah, it makes such a difference.
I know plenty of cases, not even handwritten notes, but even just getting an email from somebody that sounds sincere, you know, even if it's just something like that you're not expecting, can really, you know, having somebody who goes that extra mile to, like, check in on you and see how things are going.
At my company, you know, World Copywriting Institute, when people have a question, not necessarily even a problem, but just a question about shipping or a question about, you know, I got 4 or 5 questions from subscribers to the list about mm-hmm. whether this webcast would be recorded. I answered them.
I got the same thing.
Personally. Now, to me, it's no big deal, but, you know, then someone who's on my list, who's a very big deal in all caps marketer, told me sort of smugly that he has 234,711 emails right now and he doesn't have time to read mine. Well, what did he sign up for my list for if he doesn't want to get the announcements? I don't know, but that was real impersonal, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess I sound like I'm hurt. I'm not. I'm just using it as an annoying counterexample.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would say a big thing about relationships is giving more than is expected of you. I think in our culture, people, they expect service. You know, in our service culture these days is very much you get exactly what you paid for, if that. and not even a little bit more. And if you just take the moment to go that little extra mile, to give somebody more than they think they're paying for, you'll build a tremendous relationship with them right off the bat.
That's an excellent point. And you also have, this reminds me of your definition of marketing, which is much as I'd like to expropriate it and claim it as my own, I won't. What is your definition of marketing, Chris?
My definition of marketing is the art of making a promise and keeping it.
Making,
which sounds complicated, I know. But.
Making a promise and keeping it. Well, it sounds rare. You know, people who do that, I mean, that's really part of relationship, too. Building that kind of trust, that kind of reliability, it doesn't happen as often as maybe it should. And those who are able to run, you know, sound businesses and do that do better than those who run sound businesses and don't do that. Because you keep your customers longer.
There's also something to be said there about the, you know, the old 80-20 rule, right? Which is a lot of companies I know, and I'm sure people on this call, they worry a lot more about getting new customers and tend to ignore their old customers to their detriment. When, especially in a recession, especially when the downturn, those gold customers, repeat customers, people that you can sell to again, are absolute gold. You know, they're the gas in the tank that keeps your engine running.
That's a really good point. They are. Here's another relationship technique. Keeping a record of your customers' preferences and interests, and let them know when you see something that becomes available, whether or not you sell it, whether or not you're even going to get an affiliate commission for it. Now, there are a couple ways you can do this. One way is you can, if you have a real high-end practice or business, professional practice, you have a small number of customers, you can sort of do this by hand on index cards, whatever. If you have a lot of customers or a lot of people in your database, there are databases like Infusion, infusionsoft.com. They can handle a large number of customers for you, and you can create different groups based on people's interest, based on what they tell you. What about a phone call? Simple phone call. That's a great way. What's his name? Ari Gulper, the guy who has liveperson.com.
Oh, yeah.
People, that creates relationship, and people just rave about him. I don't know him personally, but that's really a great way to do relationship. Now, here's something, and for some people who think that the world is, you know, their therapy room, this is not a good idea. But for everyone else, most people tend to, especially if they have a newsletter business, they tend to hold back a little bit about sharing personal details. And in a, if you have a newsletter or a blog and you share a little bit about yourself without going overboard, I'm not talking about the blog that talks about your innermost feelings about your cat. I'm just talking about experiences and how you feel about things in the course of business. That can actually create relationship much more powerfully and profitably than most people realize.
I have really concrete examples of that. My own newsletter that I send out, you know, every month and do all the blog posts as well. The weird thing is here in Seattle, there are people I've never met who feel like they know me. There's people I've never met who I will see at a networking event or something like that. They walk up and say, "Hey, Chris, how you doing? Great to see you. I heard about your condo. I heard about this. I heard about that car wreck, blah, blah, blah." And there's a bond there. There's a level of intimacy there just because of the newsletter, just because of something I wrote, that sharing parts of my life, sharing, you know, what's kind of going on a more personal level.
So. That's a perfect example. That's really good. Now, did you expect that to happen when you started to share things about your life in your blog?
No, I was just trying to be, you know, it was just trying to be interesting and funny. And, you know, the next thing I know, there's people that are slavishly devoted to the whole thing.
Well, that is a great example of the relationship technique. And, of course, a lot of those people won't become your customers, but guess what? They probably know someone who would, or know someone, let's see, I guess there's 6 degrees.
Yeah.
They may need to know 5 people down the line, but sooner or later, it could turn into business for you.
It always comes back. I get a lot of calls from people all the time who, you know, I get, like, people would call me up and they say, "Hey, you know, Eric Johnson referred me." I don't even know an Eric Johnson. I've never heard of Eric Johnson, never talked to this guy, who this person is, but somehow he refers me. There's also something here I think about, you know, the relationship thing, what you're talking about so far. Golly, it sounds like a lot of work. You know, it sounds like you got to be picking up the phone a lot. You got to be sending out handwritten notes a lot. That is true. There are also, though, I think, ways to do it in a more automatic way. There are ways, they might not be quite as effective, but there are ways to take these kind of techniques and set up a system for how you deal with your customers, what kind of message you send them, how you send them. Now, I would never recommend getting down to some kind of generic-sounding boilerplate sort of thing like what you get from Verizon or something like that. You always want to have personality and verve in what you send people, but there are ways to do it without it becoming, you know, 90% of your job.
That sounds good, and that brings us to the next action question for people to write down, which is, how could you develop and make permanent a relationship between your prospect and your customer and your business? Should I do that a little more slowly?
Do it one more time, yeah.
How could you develop and make permanent a relationship between your prospect or your customer and your business?
Now, David, we have covered the three big ideas so far, which are demonstration, sampling, and relationship. But I get the feeling, as we've talked about with value here and giving more than people are expecting, that possibly, just possibly, you have a bonus idea for our listeners.
Well, Chris, you are right. I do have a bonus idea.
I knew it.
And the bonus idea is, don't cut your prices. Increase your value. Now, you know,
what does that mean, David?
Warren
what does
Buffett,
value mean?
I'm going to quote Warren Buffett to explain what it means.
Great.
The great Warren Buffett, America's most beloved investor, the second or third richest man in the world, says, price is what you pay, but value is what you get. And the fact is that it's often possible, with just a little imagination, a little elbow grease, to add a lot more value to what you're offering without adding much or even any cost to what you're selling. I'll just give you one example. I'm doing a promotion next week, and I'm throwing in a bonus people in the past have paid $600 for and very happy with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put that on top of something that normally sells for $1,000. So instead of $1,000 of value, they're going to get $1,600 worth of value for $1,000. Now, because of quantity buying, my costs are only going to increase slightly, but I know from experience that sales will double or triple just because of this bonus. So my profits will be a lot higher than if I hadn't increased the value. Even though my profit per item is going to be a little less, the number of units sold is going to be so much higher that, you know, just by increasing the value without increasing the price, maybe that's a way to look at it. Increase the value without increasing the price, and you increase your profits because you increase your volume.
And that means you don't have to lower your price. You don't have to discount. You don't have to Walmart.
You don't have to. You know, it's real hard to compete with Walmart. I think they're China's largest trading partner. And until you're China's second largest trading partner, you really – well, I guess that would be the United States of America Treasury. You really shouldn't try to compete, should you?
And it's just a really tough way to make a living. I mean, if you're basically trying to justify your value or justify your price on every sale and competing on, you know, gas prices and stuff like that, it's a really hard way to make a living. There's better. There's, you don't need to do that.
Nope.
But, yeah, huge stuff.
So question number four is, how can you add value to what you're selling? How can you add value?
Great. So, David, I know we've worked on several projects together, and you are really big not on just giving people information or theory, but on giving them action plans, an action item, a thing they can take right now when they get off the phone and excitedly, passionately type down actions they're going to take this evening or tomorrow to put this information into effect. So what kind of action plan can you suggest to our listeners?
Okay. It's very simple. Take your four questions. How can I demonstrate? How can I offer a sample? How can I create relationship? And how can I add value? And then you put together an action plan. You answer the questions, and you figure out some actions that you're going to do. And just with those answers, it may be four, or you may have more than four actions that you can take, depending on we've given you lots of examples, and you can come back to the same page that this is on and listen to it again, and if you need to review. You'll have an action plan, then put it on a calendar. So answer the questions, put together an action plan, put it on a calendar, and now here's the trick. take action, act on
mm-hmm.
it.
And I would say, add to that, there, you know, it's better to have a little change or a little thing that you're going to do tomorrow and the next day and the next day, and then have a big thing that you never get around to. You know, even if it's just taking, you know, your product and making a really, really short 30-second demonstration video, or offering a free consultation or something like that, doing something small that you're actually going to do, it is going to have a lot more of an effect on your business than making big, grandiose plans that, you know, we're all entrepreneurs on this call. We all know what the average entrepreneur's day is like. There's, you know, 17 billion emails and phone calls and things like that. Take the small stuff and actually do it and then start building on it, and you'll make more money and be a lot more successful than if you worry about the big stuff.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that's great advice. Start small and then, you know, incrementally, gradually grow. And do that, and it's going to let you profit during the recession, which is what
mm-hmm.
this whole webcast has been about.
Mm-hmm. Keep your head above the water and make more money while everyone else is dog paddling.
That's right. So you have a blog and a newsletter. And those are free, right? So
they're free.
How do people?
In a lot of ways, those are ways that I demonstrate what I can do, and then give people samples of advice and things like that. My blog is called the Hardworking Words Blog, and it can be found at hadadinc.com/blog. That's hadadink.com/blog. And you can also sign up for my newsletter on my main site, which is also a pretty darn good sales letter, I got to say, which is hadadink.com, hadadinc.com. And what about you, David? What do you have that people can learn from?
Well, I have the World Copywriting Blog, and there's lots of fun stuff and lots of how-to stuff, how to write headlines and testimonials, all kinds of different things in there. And that's at worldcopyblog.com, no dashes or hyphens or dots or anything, just www.worldcopyblog.com. And then if you are interested in getting a regular newsletter with additional information, there's the World Copywriting Newsletter at copynewsletter.com, copynewsletter.com.
And if you're not on it, it really is good content, and he always has really funny pictures on his blog posts, so you should check them out.
Why, thank you, Chris.
Good stuff, good stuff.
Well, that wraps it up, I guess. Yeah. Thank you so much for being part of this. You added a lot of value and more than a little fun. And hope everyone got some good stuff out of this. We hope to hear lots of success stories. Please send them. And thanks for joining us.
Yeah, and remember, I got a lot of emails from people on my own list who were like, I'm in Australia and I can't be awake at 4 p.m. your time. Is there going to be a recording of this? And, of course, there is. Right at the link where you're listening to this right now, there's going to be a recording, and we're going to send an email out for it. So if you liked what you heard today and want other people to hear it as well, it'll be hosted right here.
It will. So on behalf of Chris Haddad, how should I say that from now on?
Oh, you can say it however you want. It's okay.
Okay.
I say Haddad because I'm from Massachusetts.
On behalf of Chris, thanks so much, and have a very prosperous and successful year, and let the recession go somewhere else. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.